Mr. Doug Fry, Reel 13. Now, we got to the point where you'd arrived at, Stalag Luft
the
4.
Yes.
At Gross Trico.
Gross Tisha.
Not very good at that. And this is still July, 1944.
Yes.
Tell us about your first impressions of this camp then.
Well, the first impressions was because of the way we'd arrived there and seen what had happened to the column before us, the whole thing seemed pretty ominous, and there was a rather an air of foreboding over the place, quite frankly. And we'd only been there two or three days, and this came to fruition, this feeling of foreboding, because there was a storm. A dry storm. It wasn't raining, and the clouds were swirling round like in a whirlpool, and looking very angry. And there was thunder and lightning. And most of us were sitting outside these dog kennels because it was so hot and sultry. And as I say, it wasn't raining. And then the lightning struck the. Just outside the dog kennel opposite me, about perhaps 30 yards away or something like that, on the other side of the compound, and the chaps that were sitting outside, they all got a shock, but one, Roy Stevens, he was struck in such a way that he died that evening. And I saw it hit. It was just like a bomb exploding on the ground, a big flash and a boom. And so they took Roy Stevens into this room, which was the other side of the cookhouse, and laid him on a table there. And the chaps were working on him until about 8 o'clock in the evening, trying to revive him. But sadly, he died. So that was a tragedy, really, not long after he'd arrived at this dreadful camp.
Can you describe these huts a bit more? I mean, I know you briefly described them in the last row, but can you describe them just a bit more? The dog kennels? I mean,
we call them dog kennels because they were exactly like big dog kennels. They were built like that, sloping roof like dog kennels. They were painted green outside. There was no door to them.
Were they smaller than the ones you'd had previously?
Oh, they were small. They held 10 of us sleeping on the floor, so you can tell that when we filled, 10 of us filled them. If we can try and give some sort of size to them, let's say they were about 12 foot long and about 5 foot wide with a sloping roof, and I couldn't stand upright in them, so you can tell they were maybe 5 foot.
Now, what about food and things here? I mean, were you still getting your Red Cross parcels?
Food became a bit scarce here. It started to get scarce. Everything started to get scarce. However...
Was that because you weren't getting the Red Cross parcels?
Yes. A day or two after Roy Stevens was killed, I was also outside the hut just looking around and doing nothing in particular, and there was a German up the... one of the poles where and doing something with the perimeter lights. All the camps had perimeter lights around them, and he had his safety belt on, and suddenly I was watching and see what he was doing. He suddenly went stiff and fell back on his safety belt, and what had happened was somebody had turned the current on, one of his chums somewhere, and electrocuted him. So we'd had one of our chaps killed, electrocuted in effect. And also a German had been electrocuted within a couple of days. So it was quite extraordinary, really. So once more, it was adding to the nasty sort of feel of this camp altogether. And so eventually we were moved into the compound where we were supposed to be going, the so-called British compound. The huts weren't really finished in that there were no fires been put in.
Big huts again?
They were now the normal barrack huts, split into rooms with a corridor down the middle, and there were 16 of us eventually to a room, when we put six, there were 16 bunks in each room. They weren't finished. There were no fires, no grate, no fires, and there were no lights yet. But nevertheless, they put them in. They put us in there. At the end, there was an empty room with a concrete floor and a drain, and there was a copper there, an old-fashioned copper, for boiling, for heating water. So there we were, ensconced in this, in these new billets, unfinished billets. They hadn't yet. There was on the other side of the compound, the Americans had filled that part, and they had been finished, and they had a pump working as well for their water, like an old, you know, the old fashioned village pump style. And they were. But when we got into our side of the compound, a couple of German engineers, Luftwaffe engineers, were pile driving into the ground there, just outside the hut I was in, to find water to make a pump there, to sink in a well, in other words, which they eventually did. So we now had our own fresh water pumped up. In my billet there was an army chap, a Sergeant Anson, been captured in the Middle East. But now and again, the Germans did funny things, and they had army fellas mixed up with us aircrew bods for some peculiar reason. Anyway, he got the job of looking after the boiler and lighting it in the morning and so on and so forth. So eventually he was moved to an army camp. So I volunteered to take over the boiler, because I thought, if I do that, I shall not only have first call on any hot water, but I got a chance of going out of the camp, because George used to go out to get the coal blocks that we used in the stove in the billet, which had now been completed. We had now had a stove and lights. And so I thought, if I do that, I might be able to do a bit of trading with the Germans here, get a bit of bread. And this is how it turned out. So I used to go over there when they allowed me out once a week to get some more coal bricks. And I used to make one, get speaking to one of the German goons over there, German guards, and I used to manage to get a loaf of bread for some cigarettes from him. So that worked out okay. And also I used to have to get up early, of course, and get the boiler going, which was a very difficult job with the rotten coal bricks that we had. So that was that. And then some more prisoners came in, and we had four prisoners extra put into our room. There were no bunks for them, four Americans, because this camp was getting really overcrowded. And so we now had 20 people in our room. And by now, there was hardly any mail coming through at all. The Red Cross parcels began to dry up, and when they did come in, it was one between two. And the German rations went down to practically nothing. The potatoes dried up, and we were getting fed millet. They were giving us millet, and also sort of some pasta stuff, I suppose, that pinched from the Italians. So things were getting a bit fraught by this time now. And I mean, Germany was obviously cracking up completely, really, and disintegrating. So we got to Christmas. Fortunately, the American Christmas parcels got through for some reason. I don't know why. So that was a bit of a treat. There was a tin of mixed fruit amongst them, and deviled ham in a little tin, and some pate in a little tin. All this sounds very luxurious. But
were there any celebrations, I mean, that year?
No, not really. No, not really.
Now, what about, I mean, were the camp things like camp theatre and sport?
No,
was there any of that?
No, there was none of that, because there wasn't the wherewithal. We didn't have a theatre. There was a room where one or two of the chaps put on a concert, played harmonica and the guitar and stuff like that. But there wasn't the wherewithal to do any of this whatsoever. But what was there, it was... Well, everything was seemed rather sinister, if you like. It was a very nasty year about this camp, and in fact, on at least two occasions, we were kicked out of our billets and made to go behind the cookhouse building, and the guards in the box, in the Boston boxes, in the guard boxes, guard towers, fired their machine guns into the compound. And we learned later that this guy Picard, who was supposed to have been an ardent Nazi, he was preparing this business, rehearsing to bump us all off, apparently, according to some German officers that were at the camp. I've got all these bits and pieces.
Did you know much about Picard yourself? I mean,
no,
at the time,
didn't see him anymore. No, we didn't see him anymore. We didn't see him anymore after we'd seen him on the road, yelling and shouting and urging these buds on to stab our chaps and beat them over the head and so on. Didn't see him anymore, but he was still in the camp because it was him that got the.
Well, you found out about this later.
Yeah.
So what happened next then?
As I say, things began to dry up, everything dried up, food was drying up, things were getting quite full, mail was drying up, so everything was getting bad. And then we got into the winter, which was also became very severe, blizzards, and in no time at all we had a couple of feet of snow on the ground. And when we got through Christmas okay, as I say, the American Christmas parcels, food parcels, came through.
You mentioned that.
Yeah, I mentioned that. And so now we're into the new year. We were getting a bit concerned because we thought that we would have finished it by then. I think the general consensus of opinion was that we would have finished the war by the end of the year, but of course we didn't. So we were beginning to think maybe that, you know, we were still in some sort of problems here, since everything was drying up. And when it came to pass in beginning of February, there was all these rumours going around that the Russians were really advancing again in their sort of winter offensives, and the rumours were going around that we were going to be moved again. So we sort of shrugged this off for a while. Then the rumours got stronger. Then, yes, we are going. So we all started to make preparations.
What preparations did you make?
Well, I had these two German blankets. Incidentally, I'll come to something later. I had these two German blankets, so I sewed them together to make a sleeping bag. I thought that would be more convenient and easier to carry and to use. And also, my mother sent me a small bag, what I call a small kit bag, that I had. She sent that out to me, one of the parcels, and I altered that so that it was like a knapsack, so I could carry it on my back. I did that, and somebody had an old kit bag. We got some material and made some leggings to put around our trousers. But also, we'd been issued with boots, RAF boots at Heiderkrug. Obviously, I needed that, so that was good. So I had some good boots. Fortunately. So I was ready. And then on the early morning of the 6th of February, 45, I suppose around about 5 in the morning, we were roused out into the snowing again, roused out into the snow, lined up, and so we knew that we were on our way, but we were kept hanging about there until it was daylight. And we didn't move off till around about 8 o'clock or thereabouts. And so we marched out of the gate. And as we marched out, we reached handed two parcels each. So there had been parcels in the camp, but they hadn't been giving them to us. So they cleared out the camp, gave us two each. And of course, that was awkward because they didn't stop us marching so that we could put this stuff away. So we were trying to open these parcels and put the stuff into our kit bags and to our kit and so on and so forth, and pockets. So a lot of the stuff got thrown away because some of the chaps said to the guard, well, where are we going? He said, oh, we're going up to marching to another camp. So some of the chaps, I think I did the same, threw some stuff away, like tins of margarine and so on out of the parcels to lessen the weight. In the event, we weren't going to another camp at all. We were just on the open road. So we started off, as I say, around about 8 o'clock, half past 8 in the morning of the 6th of February. And we were marching all day with now and again a 5-minute rest. And eventually we were obviously going to make for somewhere to sleep for the night. And the blooming column I was in, it was now getting dark. It was depth of winter. Got dark about 3:30. And the chap who was had a map, the German in charge of my small column, because it was split into smaller columns, you see. He lost us. We were lost. So we were walking about, tramping about in the blinding snow, in pitch black, looking for this farm where we were supposed to stay the night. We eventually found it, because the other column had already got there and they were already bedded down. So we had to go up in the loft, up these steps into the loft.
In the barn?
In this barn, at last. And because it was pitch black out there, of course. So we're stepping over the bods who were sound asleep and snoring. And freezing cold, of course, and hungry. Had nothing to eat. And when I woke up in the morning, I found that I was lying right on the edge of an opening in the floor of this blooming barn, and with about a 10-foot drop to all the chaps below. So if I'd have rolled over that to the right, I would have fallen down amongst this lot, probably broken my neck. Incredible. If I didn't move all night. Anyway, up we got, and I think they rousted out some hot water and we made a brew. And then as soon as that was, we didn't even get a chance to finish that, we were off marching again. So there we were, chomping across Germany in this terrible weather. Hardly anything to eat or drink all day. And then getting put up at barns at night. So this continued day after day for about a week or more. And by this time, what Red Cross food we'd had was gone. And we were in a very severe state. And so we had a rest up, a day's rest at this particular farm. And I don't know whether it was for us or for the guards. Anyway, we were milling around there, wondering what was happening. And we heard Vic Clark now had given his parole and he'd borrowed a bike. And he was now chasing around looking for Red Cross parcels, because apparently the International Red Cross, they knew about what all the people on the road. And although the Germans hadn't given them any specifics, they were making food parcel dumps at various spots so that we could any columns could go and help themselves. So Mick Clark found one of these and a lorry and brought the parcels into the camp. So we had, on this day of rest, a parcel between two. Now, a little incident occurred here. I was milling around looking to see if there was anything we could pinch or whatever with old Danny Heath, a friend of mine. And we saw this queue outside the back of the farmhouse. So I thought, this is good, what's going on? And the bods were standing there with towels under their arm, you see. So what's going on? Oh, she's the lady in the farm is getting hot water for us to have a bath. Wow. Oh, that's great. So I've joined the queue, got into the entrance to the kitchen, big kitchen with quarry tile floor, and there was the old fashioned copper there where the water was being heated, and then this big sort of tub, wooden tub, about 3 foot deep, I suppose it was, and about 4 or 5 foot across. There were two bods in it already, just see the heads above it, but across the top of it was a thick grey scum. Oh dear, it was terrible. So I thought, well, God, I shall come out there dirtier than I'll go in. So I never bothered, because all the hot water had run out, so they couldn't top it up anymore. But some of the chaps did have a hot dip there. So that was good. Another thing, old Danny, another incident there, because every farm had these poor Russians working there. And old Danny, he had this watch. It didn't work. It didn't have any glass in it. It had a bit of cellophane paper over it with a rubber band. I think he'd got it from a Canadian, but I don't know why, because it didn't work. Anyway, he had it on, and one of these Russians saw it, started looking at it. Oh, I don't know all this business. And so Danny thought, I've got a chance here of trading. So with sign language, he said, you can have this if you get us some bread. So this Rusky went off, brought back a loaf of bread, black bread, the usual issue, and handed it over. And Danny gave him this watch, and the three or four other Russians were around, all chatting amongst themselves. And it's quite astonishing. They never seem to have seen a watch before, or heard one ticking or anything, because they took it. Danny gave him this watch. He put it on, strapped it up, and they're listening for it to tick, and it wasn't ticking, but they're all listening and chatting away there. Oh God, Danny, when they find out that that's not, they're going to come after us, or you did it, not me. Anyway, we shared the loaf of bread, and they didn't come after us, so perhaps they thought it was I don't know. But it was a peculiar incident, but it's absolutely true. These Ruskies, they were really basic, these Ruskies, they're real peasant types. And I don't think they'd had anything in their lives, really, you know, shocking. So that was that little incident. Anyway, so we got our Red Cross, and we had this loaf that Danny had traded in his Duff watch for. So we finished the day rather happily, really. And then off we went the next morning again on the march. So one day was as bad as the last, really, because it was terrible weather still, raining and freezing. We were sopping wet all day long. At one stage, if I recall very vividly, on one of the stops, I tried to undo my pack to see if I had anything to eat in it, and I couldn't. I was too cold. My hands were so cold, I couldn't open it. Not that I don't think I had anything in there to eat anyway. So I just lay back on it, and I dozed off on this snowy bank. Well, then came the furtig barking from the Germans to get up and go, and I was asleep. So the chaps had to wake me up to get on my feet and get underway again. And it proved to me that what we'd often heard, that if you went to sleep in cold weather in those conditions, you would just sleep and you'd die in your sleep, you wouldn't wake up. And I think that's absolutely true, because it could have happened to me. It's incredible, really. So, as I say, one day was as bad as the last, and we were continued marching and going. Staying, sometimes we stayed out in the open, slept in the open, and one day we had another rest day. We turned up at this farm, and it was day, by now the days were drawing out. Although the weather was still very bad, the days were drawing out. So when we were arriving at the barns, it was still daylight. So we arrived at this barn, and on one side by the farmhouse there was this big rabbit hutch with a nice big black and white bunny rabbit in it. And on the other, there was a big churn full of, what do they call it? Not whey, buttermilk. So, and it didn't have a lid on it. So we helped ourselves. As we went past, we dipped our mugs in there. So he lost his buttermilk with the farmer. So when we were sleeping in a field that night. By now, there were six of us in this combine. And one of them was a chap from my room in Le Four, Davy Baxter, and he'd been he was a ground crew captured at Crete, but he'd been a trainee butcher with a co-op before he went into the Air Force. So we thought, right, there's a bunny rabbit there, it looks like food. So we delegated him, because he was a trainee butcher, we thought he'd be ideal to give this bunny the rabbit the chop, you see. So one of the chaps, we used to, as we went through farms, if we saw something that might come in handy, we would pinch it. And one of the chaps had an axe, he'd pick a small axe or chopper that he'd found. So he had that. So David, we said, David ran to the hut. He came back with the bunny. He'd give it a bash, but he hadn't killed it. So when he came back, the thing was sticking out of his coat with his ears, his all bright eyes, this bunny rabbit. So he had to give it the chop. Chopped it up, skinned it, we buried the skin, chopped it up with his axe, and by now they were letting us light fires, the Luftwaffe guards. So we lit a fire as best we could, and one of the chaps had a tin can that he'd helped himself along the way, got some water in that, and we boiled up this, cut this bunny rabbit up and boiled it, and we have a bit of bunny rabbit each, half cooked. I didn't like bunny rabbit anyway, but I ate it. So that was a little bunny rabbit. I mean, when you skinned a bunny rabbit, there's not much of it. But we had a bit. There were six of us shared this bunny rabbit. So we were rather glad to get away from that farm, because we thought, well, if they're going to find out their bunny's gone, and they're going to want to find out where it went to.
No, another time you got some Swedes, I think. I
mean, oh, well, that was another.
Scavenging for food.
Yeah, yeah, that was
Tell
another.
Tell us that story.
Well, that was another. That was farther along. As I say, each day was just as bad, and it was just a question of slogging along until you got to where you were going to sleep that night, and hopefully there might be something to eat there or some hot water to make a brew if you had anything left in your kit, but you know, coffee or whatever. So we got to this place, likewise in daylight, and milling about in the mud. I wondered if we could trade or barter or find something or steal something to eat. And there was a little this brick lean-to, and I looked inside, and it was a store place for these Swedes, big heaps of Swedes in the corner, big heap of them. I thought, well, I'll have one of them, I could eat that. So I picked one up, put it in my coat, but a German guard had been standing there, and he saw me do it. So he came over and started rousting me and made me put it back. And he still kept rousting me, so I lost my temper and started arguing with him, and he argued back. I mean, just at that time, he argued back, and then he lost his temper, I lost my temper, and he pointed his gun at me and cocked it, and I thought, well, I think I'll jag this in now. Discretion is the better part of valor. So I turned my back on him to walk away, and he swung at me, and anyway, the chap called out, look out, Doug, and I did look out, and I ducked, and he just caught me a glancing blow across the back. Anyway, at that time, we had a felt waver. We called him, he had a club foot, and he used to drive a ride about on a bike up and down the common. And we called him three times whistling because he had a whistle. And he spoke fairly good English. And he used to say, when I am three times whistling, you've got to line up. So we called him three times whistling, you see. Anyway, he'd heard this commotion between the guard and myself. So he came over and said, you've got to do as you're told. He said, we are the masters now. He said, we are the masters. And I said, yes, you won't be for long. I said, then you watch out. And then he just shrugged his shoulders and cleared off on his bike. But that was an incident. But the thing there is I didn't get my Swede. I had to put it back, you see. That's that, because you could eat Swedes. And, good, we ate anything. We could find sugar beets. We tried sugar beets. Oh, that half sweet. I tell you, made your throat sore. That was so sweet. But...